We're in Genesis chapter 45 tonight, as we're nearing the end of this long section of history. And in addition to, of course, the history, God has taught us a lot of important things, a lot of principles in these chapters to help us, even though many of these events took place 4,000, 5,000, even 6,000 years ago, some of them, but they still teach us today. Because no matter how long this world endures, the basic flaws, the basic characteristics of human beings never changes. I know that people are different here and there, but the fact of the matter is, there are certain key characteristics of human beings, certain flaws that we have, certain temptations that we fall to. Just like the Corinthian writer Paul tells us, that no temptation has overtaken you except what is common to man. And so when we look at these things and we see the temptations that they faced, they're no different than the temptations we face today. They may come in a little different shape, a different color, a different dress, but it's the same temptations just fixed up and dressed up for us today, the same things they faced back then. When we last left Joseph and his family, Joseph had finally called his brothers back because they had caught Benjamin with that silver cup. And finally, the ultimate test, Judah, the very one who had been the one to suggest selling Joseph into slavery back at the beginning of the story of Joseph and his brothers, is now offering to stay as a slave himself in order to let Benjamin go free to go back home. And this apparently is what Joseph has been waiting for. He's been wanting to see. Remember when his brothers first came, they said, "Oh no, we're not spies. We're true men. We're honest men." Well, the brothers Joseph knew and had experience with weren't honest, true men. And so he's been testing them slowly but surely. And now here we come to the final test, and Judah has passed this final test. And if this is apparently what Joseph has been waiting for, because at this point, as we begin chapter 45, it says, "Then Joseph could not refrain himself before all them that stood by, and he cried, 'Cause every man to go out from me. And there stood no man with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers.'" He just couldn't hold it in any longer. You know, the first trip, he held it, and he was rough with them, and he sent them away. They were gone for a year. After a year of drought, they came back. After the year of famine, so the second year of famine, and here they come back. And then he was sending them away again, but he made the arrangements to get them to come back with the silver cup. And so here they are, and the emotions of the situation have overcome him. And I know we mentioned it last time, but I'm going to mention it again. Joseph was a man. He was a strong man. He had been through some things. He was a man of character. He wouldn't give in to Potiphar's wife. He was thrown in prison, and yet he still triumphed. I mean, a lot of us would have trouble living in prison, and yet he triumphed. He was at the top of the heap. He was a strong man. He was a tough guy. But in verse 2, the emotions of this situation so overwhelmed him that he wept so loudly that Pharaoh's household heard it. Now, I don't know how close Joseph's house and Pharaoh's house were that they were hearing these things go on. But even if they were next door neighbors, well, now, not counting J.L. and Hazel, because their next-door neighbors are about a mile away. But for many of us, you know, if our next-door neighbors heard us crying, we'd be crying pretty loud. Joseph was weeping. He was weeping aloud as he let his brothers know who he was. He announces himself, "I'm Joseph." Well, they're in shock. Now, whether it's disbelief because They've been telling the lie that Joseph was dead for so many years, they've probably started to believe it themselves. So there's probably a piece of that in there. But then there's also some fear. What if this really is Joseph? If this is really Joseph, and he's Lord over Egypt, and here we are, and he could do whatever he wants with us after the way we treated him. So there's some fear in there too. And the Bible says that they were so frozen in these things that they were speechless. They couldn't even answer him. Maybe there was a little bit of disbelief, maybe a little bit of fear, but all mixed up in there. They didn't know what to do, and they didn't know what to say. And so in verse 4, Joseph called them, you know, come closer, and he said, really, I am your brother Joseph that you sold into slavery. Well, that doesn't exactly comfort them any. And so, in verse 5, in a reversal of roles, I mean, here they are, they should be saying, oh, you know, please don't be mad at us for what we did to you. But instead, Joseph here is telling them, well now, it's okay, don't worry about it, don't be angry at yourselves over what happened. And that seems almost backwards, doesn't it? Joseph's the one that got sold, and he's telling them not to be angry. Why would they be angry? Well, they might be angry at themselves. They're feeling some guilt. It's probably overwhelming them at this point that they finally realize what they actually did back then. And they realize what consequences could face them. They could face death for what they've done. They're in a foreign country. No one there speaks their language. They don't have a representative. There's not an ambassador. There's no consulate that they could go running to protect them. If Joseph decided to have them thrown in the dungeon, he can. He's already shown that. He did it with Simeon for a year. Simeon was in the dungeon for a year while they were going back home to their father to bring Benjamin back and all of those things. So there's a great deal of emotion going on in this room with these 12 men, Joseph and his 11 brothers. But Joseph explains to them that God brought him to this point. That yes, they played a role. Yes, they did sell him into slavery, but it was with God's purpose in mind that God brought him. He's made peace with this. Probably he made peace with it when Pharaoh had his dream and he called on Joseph, and Joseph realized the role that he was going to play in saving the world, the known world of that area at least, from this huge famine that was over the whole area. And so Joseph has made peace with what they did, and realizing that even through the hard times that he's had, God's been with him and God's blessed him. And that's what he says to them. That's what he explains to them in verses 4 and in verse 5 as well. In verse 4, at the end of it, he says, at the end of verse 5, he says, for God did send me before you to preserve life. You see, if Joseph had come down with his brothers a year into the famine, it would have been too late to do anything. The good years would have already passed. The opportunity to save up and store up for the bad years would have been lost. It would have been gone. Well, then in verse 6, he explains it more fully. He says, there's 2 years there's been this famine in the land, and there are still 5 years left, and there's going to be no earing, no harvest. Now, I don't know that, you know, not necessarily means there's not going to anything grow, but it's not going to be enough of a harvest to count for anything. They're not going to have enough food to sustain themselves through the winter based on what's going to happen over the next couple of years, next 5 years based on what's happened the last 2 years. 7 years of famine, remember. They're only 2 years into it at this point. And so he says in verse 7, God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity on the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. And so he says in verse 8, it was not you that sent me here, but it was God. Joseph is an amazing example of faith for us. An amazing example of forgiving spirit as well. I can't begin to imagine the feelings that being sold into slavery by your brothers would stir up within you in the first place. And I know a lot of years have passed, but I know that most people would hold on to that grudge for a long, long time, and they'd still probably be holding on to it all these many years later. But Joseph shows us how much better it is to forgive what's in the past and live for the day. Now, you know, a lot of people, he might have said, well, you know, I'll save Benjamin and my father, but I'm not going to save those other fellows. They can just starve in this famine. They get what's coming to them. But that's not what Joseph's attitude was at all. You see, in many ways, and perhaps you've probably heard this term used before, but I'll explain it anyway. In many ways, Joseph was a type of Christ. When there's somebody in the Old Testament who shows a foreshadowing of something that's going to happen in the New Testament, that's called a type. And then when the thing in the New Testament is revealed, that's the antitype. Well, there are a lot of ways in which Joseph is a type of Christ. He saved the world. Now, he didn't save them from their sins. He saved them from a famine. So in that, you know, it's different from what Jesus did, but he was a savior of sorts. In fact, the name that he was given by Pharaoh and the other Egyptians was bringer of life or giver of life, because he saved their lives. And also we see then in this area of forgiveness that Joseph foreshadows the kind of forgiveness that Christ had. Joseph was sold by his brothers. Jesus was sold by Judas and betrayed by his own people, his brethren, if you will, even though they weren't his flesh and blood brothers, but they were you know, cousins and fifth and cousins and 17th cousins, and his whole nation, the nation of the Jews, betrayed him to the Romans. And yet both of them, when push came to shove, were willing to have this forgiving attitude. And this is the kind of thing that we need to learn from these great Bible heroes. Joseph is a hero. There aren't many people who could do or would do, would be willing to do what he did. And yet, because of what he did, he saved not only his family, not only the nation of Egypt and all the others that came to Egypt for the food, but he also saved the line through which Christ would come. That's an important factor. Notice what he says. He mentions the posterity. He mentions the descendants here. God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth. To preserve your descendants, in essence. And that's really significant. Because Judah, one of those brothers that he's saving, one of those brothers that most of us would have said, well, let him starve to death, he's getting what he deserved. That Judah was the tribe, was the father of the tribe through which Christ came. And Joseph had a huge role in that. Then we notice, as we go further on, that God, he gives God the credit for these things. He doesn't take the credit himself. He doesn't say, well, I was so good at interpreting dreams that Pharaoh gave me this big job over the whole country and all that. No, he says, God has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Israel. He said, God's done it. God did these things. And then he says, go back home and tell my father, tell Jacob what's going on. Tell him that God, that I'm alive and that God's made me ruler over Egypt. And he tells them to go do it and hurry back. Hurry back and bring Jacob back as well. He wants the whole family, verse 10 tells us, he wants the whole family to come live in the land of Goshen, which was one of the richest areas for cattle and for ranching, that kind of thing, in the whole land of Egypt. And he wants his family to be able to live there. Of course, during this famine time, even the richest area wasn't very rich, but it was still the best area that was offered. Well, in verse 11, he promises then that he'll take care of them during the 5 remaining years of this famine. Because otherwise, they're going to wind up destitute. They're going to wind up in poverty. There's no other solution for them that's going to help them. You know, they're cattle are going to get sick because there's not going to be enough grass for them to eat. And they're going to start to die off. And their crops, if any crops, they're not going to be able to buy anything. And they'd be in a horrible situation. And so he says, you come here and I'll take care of you through the 5 years of famine that's left. And again, he has given God the credit for all of these things. He hadn't taken credit for it himself, that he's in this position to be able to do this. Then in verse 12, he tries again to reassure them that it's really me, and I'm really saying this. It's, you know, I'm not deceiving you. This isn't somebody. It's me. You've seen it. You've heard it with your own ears and with your own eyes. You know, you've seen it here. And they're still, I'm sure, in total shock at the turn of events that they never could have imagined. In their wildest dreams that these things could have happened. And Benjamin hug and kiss and weep together, and he kisses each of his brothers, and he hugs them and he weeps with them. And then finally, after all of these things have happened, after all of this show of emotion and the affection as well, finally they're at ease enough that they can talk to him. I can't imagine the kinds of emotions that would be running through their minds under these circumstances. I think about another time and similar, and we mentioned Joseph being a type of Christ of sorts. After Jesus was denied by Peter those 3 times on the night of his trials and his betrayal. I can't imagine the emotions running through Peter when Peter saw the Lord again after his resurrection. What must that have been like? To wonder, is he going to reject me? Is he going to cast me away? Or is he going to take me back? Or, you know, he probably remembered the story that Jesus had told about that son, the prodigal son that had run off and wasted his father's living and came back, and he wondered, is Jesus going to treat me that way? Is he going to be able to accept me after what I did? You know, after Peter did those 3 denials and the rooster crowed, he went out and he wept bitterly knowing what he had done. And I wonder about these brothers. I wonder how many sleepless nights they may have had knowing what they'd done to their brother and wishing that they could take it back and not having any idea how to correct the problem that they had caused. Verse 16, Pharaoh even hears that Joseph's brothers had come, and he's pleased. The other Egyptians, his servants, they're all pleased. Everyone's happy that Joseph's family has come to him. And Pharaoh sends a message to Joseph to tell his brothers that they should go get their father and their families and move to Egypt. And Pharaoh promised them the best of the land. He says, the fat of the land. Now, I know in our society, fat's a bad thing. But back then, fat was good. It was the best of the land that was offered. And Pharaoh promised they would have it. And in addition to that, he commanded them to take some wagons for the women and the children to ride on so they wouldn't have to walk all the way. It's a pretty good ways from Canaan to Egypt. A long walk, so he sent some wagons with them. He reminded them that the good of all Egypt was going to be theirs. And so they left with wagons and provisions for the journey. Joseph gave each of them a new outfit, but he gave Benjamin 5 outfits. He gave him 5 new sets of clothes. And 300 pieces of silver to Benjamin. Didn't give any of the others any money. I guess he figured they got their share when they sold him. They already had their money. But Benjamin, he gave him 300 pieces of silver and all these clothes. And then he also sent 10 donkeys with goods from Egypt and another 10 donkeys with food of various different kinds for Jacob's journey. So I guess he thought his dad was a big eater. I mean, 10 donkeys loaded down with food. Either that's going to be a really long journey or somebody is really hungry. I don't know if one man could eat all of that. But he sends all of that to his father and with his brothers to take home to Jacob. Finally, he gives them a warning in verse 24. When he finally sends them away, it's with the warning to be careful on the way. Now, the King James says that you do not fall out on the way. And there's several different ideas about what exactly that fall out means. It could be the idea of, you know, you've heard of people having a falling out where they start fussing and fighting amongst each other. And some people believe it's best that, you know, they might start fighting with each other on the way back because of what's happened here. The other is, you know, the idea of falling out, just like, you know, getting tired and weary and passing out. And that's a possibility. Whatever the case is, he's telling them, you know, go, don't get lost, don't get sidetracked, don't, you know, go home, get Dad and bring him back. And don't get off into other things along the way. He just warns them to beware of that. Well, when they get back to Canaan, and they tell Jacob everything that Joseph said, and probably what Pharaoh said too, and they tell him the whole story, Joseph's alive and he's the ruler over Egypt. Jacob doesn't believe him. I mean, you know the saying, don't you? Anything that's too good to be true is too good to be true. That sounds too good to be true. It is. And so when Jacob hears this, I mean, this is better than his wildest dreams. It's too good to be true. He doesn't believe it. And only when he sees the wagons does he begin to believe that what they're telling him is really the truth. But see, part of the problem is Jacob had mourned Joseph's death. Jacob had been in sorrow for years over it and finally had come to peace with the fact that Joseph was gone, finally had accepted it, and then lo and behold, just as soon as he's accepted the horrible situation that, yeah, Joseph's gone forever, then lo and behold, Joseph's not dead after all. Now, we know that's not a resurrection, but in Jacob's mind, it was like one. Here was a son who was dead, and now he's alive again. He was gone. It's kind of like Abraham with Isaac. Abraham considered that if God that if he killed Isaac, God could raise him from the dead. God has brought back a son to Jacob here that he thought was lost and dead and gone forever. What a difference a year or two can make in somebody's life. You remember when the brothers came back the first time and they said, you know, we got to go back and get some more. And Jacob said, no. He said, you can't take Benjamin. Said, you can't do that. Said, I'm bereaved of Joseph and I've lost Simeon now and you want to take Benjamin away from me and all these things are against me. Well, now, Benjamin comes home, Simeon comes back, and they tell him, Joseph's over there waiting to see you. All those things that were against him are suddenly things that are for him. And so he accepts it. He finally decides, I'm going to go see Joseph before I die. I'm going to go. It's worth the risk. One more time. to go try to see my son. And I don't know sometimes whether these are more about Jacob or more about Joseph, but you know, we've talked about before that in reality, the main character in all of these things is God. And isn't it interesting how God can work through things that we thought were against us and turn them for us? Isn't that what Romans 8 and verse 28 tells us? That God works all things together for good for them that love Him and are the called according to His purpose. Jacob and Joseph and Joseph's brothers were no doubt God's chosen called people. We know that. And look how He worked things out for good. Now notice, you know, that verse in Romans doesn't say that only good things will happen to you. There are a lot of things that aren't good that happen to us, but that can be turned for good if we'll allow it. If we'll trust in God. You know, I think about building muscle. Not that I do any of that. I haven't built a muscle in probably 15 years or more. But when I did lift weights and things for football and wrestling stuff, but when I did that, the way that worked is you push those muscles and push those muscles till you actually tore some of those muscles down. Some of those muscle cells were actually torn and broken. They were actually damaged. But the body overcompensated and in a couple of days rebuilt those stronger than they were before. That's the way exercise works. The old saying, no pain, no gain. That's the way muscle is built. You have to first actually hurt that muscle and then it'll build back stronger than it was before. That's the way it is with us in our Christian lives. We can go through life weak our entire life. But in order to be strong, we're going to have to be broken down from time to time. We're going to have to be pushed, and we're going to have to go through some pain, because the pain's what makes us stronger. You know, if I were going to run a marathon, which I have no intention of ever doing, but if I were going to run a marathon, I couldn't sit around on the couch resting, thinking, okay, if I rest up real good, I'll be able to run that marathon. No, no. If you're going to run a marathon, you've got to get out there and train, and you've got to suffer in order to be able to make it through that thing when the time comes. Well, the Christian life is a marathon. Joseph had the right attitude. Joseph let God tear him down and build him up, and tear him down and build him up, and tear him down and build him up, till he built him up to where Joseph was a strong individual. The same thing happened in Jacob's life. Jacob was torn down and built up and torn down and built up. And he got stronger and stronger each time, just like those muscles will. But we've got to let God do that to us. But we've got to trust God that He knows what He's doing and that He will work that together for our good. It's hard sometimes. Because when it comes to the future, we're blind. We're all blind. We don't know what the future holds. We don't know what's going to happen next. We can't see how something's going to turn out. That's why we have to trust God, because He can see the future just as clearly as we can see the past day. As we know what happened today, He knows what's going to happen tomorrow or next month or next year. He can see it that clearly. And that being the case, we need to trust Him. Jacob in the last chapter had finally grown to the point of trusting God. Judah in the last chapter had finally grown to the point where he was willing to sacrifice for those he loved like God wanted him to, trusting that it would work out for the best. Joseph has learned to trust God. We need to be like these men. We need to learn to trust God, that He knows what's going to be best for us. And it may involve some pain. It may involve some problems. It may involve some things that we would rather avoid and skip out on. But that's not what's best for us. God knows that if we're going to be strong, we're going to have to make it through the tough times. Tonight, if you're not a Christian, how are you going to make it through the tough times without God? Not strong enough. We talked about that this morning in our lesson. That none of us as human beings are strong enough without the support of God, without Him protecting us. We need to believe that Jesus is the Son of God and repent of your sins. Confess Him as the Christ and be buried with Him in baptism to wash your sins away. And then He'll begin to mold you. He'll begin to do things for you that you never imagined could be done as soon as you submit yourself to Him and allow Him to do that. If you're here and you are a Christian, you're not going to make it on your own either. You've got to continue living the faithful life, but you've got to trust God to lead you where you need to go in that faithful life. It will not happen by accident, but it will happen by God's purpose. Two or three times in this chapter, Joseph said, God has done this. God brought me here. And God didn't do it miraculously. One of the wonderful things about the situation with Joseph's life is for the most part, it wasn't miraculous. Yeah, I know there were the dreams that he interpreted, but most of the other things that he did in his life were not miraculous things, just like our lives. We've got to trust God. We've got to hold tight to His hand because He can see where we're going. I sing that song sometimes, that I don't know about tomorrow, but I know who holds my hand and I know who holds tomorrow. He's the one that knows it all. He's got hold of tomorrow, and if we'll hold on to Him, we'll be safe all the way through it. We'll be safe even through death. And that's part of the path as well. But as long as we're holding on to His hand, we'll make it safely through that. If you need to respond tonight for any reason, please do so as we stand and as we sing.